On this week's show, we can train better in construction. Learn how to create lifelong learners with Ian Theodore from Austin Commercial. In this week's news, is the industrial real estate market signaling more construction in 2024? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
We got another episode. I'm really excited. Jacob, how are you? Thanks for sitting down with me today.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. I'm doing pretty good. I don't know if you've noticed, but Viatechnik's making some big moves in the market these days.
I have noticed that I am gaining a friend every day, it feels like, at Viatechnik over there. I think that Danielle is doing some interesting things. We gotta lure her onto the show at some point.
I agree. This is definitely time to get her back on. Maybe her and Rick can come on and talk with what they're doing now.
Oh no, I don't know if I can handle that one. But before we get to that one, you brought a fantastic guest today. The pre-call with Ian was fantastic. Ian, say hello to everybody, introduce yourself, and let's get diving into more about you.
So my name is Ian Theodore, and I am director of training for Austin Commercial. We are a large general contractor based in Dallas, Texas, but we operate pretty much everywhere in the United States of America. And one of the interesting things about Austin is that we're a subsidiary of a larger corporation, but the entirety of our organization is an employee-owned company. So we, the employees, own pieces of the company. We don't have a Mr. Austin anywhere or anything like that.
There's no Mr. Austin. I like that. Those ESOPs are great. You know, the employee-owned stuff is great. But let's dig in a little bit about you, because that's what we heard on the pre-call, is you kind of have a pretty good history. How did you get here to Austin Commercial as a trainer? You know, we'll talk about what you're doing now as a director of training, but how did you get here?
I'll start by saying that if you hear my accent, that it's from east of southeast Texas. And I'm from a little island in the Caribbean that is called Antigua and Barbuda. And so shout out to my folks from there. And that's where I grew up. I've been around construction for all my life, pretty much. Since I was about 5 years old, I've been going on job sites with my dad. He was a contractor. And so I grew up in the business. At age 13, I was doing estimates and takeoffs and helping process payroll and paper tablets. And went to school, did my high school. And in the British system, you go to college before you go to university. So I did my college, which was called A-levels, there. And when I was done, I started working for my dad, because in the Caribbean, when you have certain aptitudes, like here as well, they either push you towards architecture or engineering. And I knew I wanted to build. And so for a little while, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. So for 3 years, I worked with my dad running work, you know, running the business. And I went to visit my sister one summer. She was in college here in the U.S. And her roommates had left her books out. And I started looking at them and said, you know, this is what is she studying? This is construction. And so she took me over to the college and showed it to me. And I applied and came back the following year. Fast forward 3 years, got my degree. And my first job offer had me going to New York City. So I took a job offer with O'Brien Kreitzberg, they're now defunct. Moved to New York City and then moved to Atlanta, with a company called H.J. Russell out of Atlanta. And started doing joint ventures. So I did a lot of joint ventures, aviation, sports facilities, industrial projects for them. And that brought me here to Dallas. And that's where I met Austin. We were helping them with the American Airlines Center, where the Mavericks play. And then from there, I moved over to DFW Airport and Terminal D and became an Austin employee. And then after that, I changed companies again and stayed with a local firm called Robinson Industries, and spent another 7-8 years at DFW Airport. So 9 years total at DFW Airport. After that, I went out to do some DART work, which is transit. So I did some transit projects here in Dallas as well. Then decided to strike out on my own. And so I started a firm. And through that, I partnered with J.E. Dunn on a project. And while we were not successful, I liked the company and the people, and they said, why don't you come work for us? So I made a move to go work for them. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your position, a year in, Austin came to me and said, hey, we really like your ideas about special systems and technology. We'd like you to come start up a group within us for that. And so that's how I came back to Austin after a 13-year gap. The idea was, and we were a little bit ahead of our time, to put a group of technology specialists together. And so I started hiring different technology people. And so just, you know, put it in perspective, most technology people know their one system that they're the specialist at. Maybe two today, because so many of those systems now are running on an IP backbone. So I started hiring RCDDs, AV people, security people, me being the linchpin. I'm the jack of all trades, master of none. And, you know, so I became the linchpin. But the key was that those people didn't know construction processes. They didn't know how we do RFIs and the documentation and the contract terms and so forth. So I started writing a training program for them to teach them all of the things that a regular construction project engineer would learn as they came out of college. And then when Austin decided to make some changes, they told me that, hey, we've been looking for someone to head up our training for the company. They offered that to me. And so that's how I became the director of training. So I'll tell you a funny story about what made me want to do training. So when I took that job and moved to New York City, I was walking down the street in Brooklyn. And remember, I've never been to New York before. I am as green. It was almost as if I was from Kansas and being in New York City. And a guy walks up to me and he taps me on the shoulder and he says, excuse me, are you Eddie Theodore's son? My dad's name is Eddie. And of course, I'm in New York City. So the first thing is I step back and I'm kind of looking at him. And he said, do you still like to ask so many questions? And I says, I don't know who you are, but you got me. Because that's the thing that I was known for, and I'm still known for. I like to ask why. Anyway, he looks at me, shook my hand, and he said, your dad made me a man. But what my dad used to do was, if you came to work for him as a laborer, whatever, he would observe you for a week. And then he would decide which track you were going to be on. So, you know, growing up, there were really two tracks. You were either in the carpentry trades or you were in the masonry trades. And so you were going to be picked for one of those two, and he would buy you your first tool, and he would put you with those tradesmen and say, okay, that's what you're going to become. And there's a whole host of men that my dad basically developed that way. Now, just a shameless plug about Austin, if I don't think I did at the beginning. We are an employee-owned company. We're part of a large organization, Austin Industries, which is one a very large company. We do a couple of billion a year. In the road and bridge division, it's one of our sister companies. We have an industrial division as well that's in oil and gas and industrial areas. Austin Commercial, we are pretty much in the construction side, stadiums, hospitals, airports, campus buildings, et cetera. That's our area. Semiconductor, we have a good market share in semiconductor and, of course, aviation. And what I decided to focus on, most companies have their training as part of their HR department. And that also is with our sister companies as well. Where we're different is I'm from the business. I understand our business. I understand the training needs of our business. The thing that's different about what I did is that I've said that training needs to be all across the board. So traditionally, we've had training for project engineer to project manager. One of our big focuses is develop training for our superintendents, especially since so many of the young superintendents are not coming up through the trades anymore. They're coming out of college. And so they need to learn all the things that, you know, a guy would have taken 20 years to learn coming up through the field as a carpenter, a foreman, et cetera. They need to learn that with a 5-year degree, a 4-year degree. They need to learn that right away. And then we wanted to have training for everybody. So training is a company thing. There's no one that doesn't need training. And so what we've done is we've taken the rules that we have for around training, and we've applied it to every, I call it a job family. So if you're in marketing, we have training for you. If you're in administration, we have training for you. If you're in VDC, we have a training program for you. We have certain core values, and I'll just use safety as one. That's a huge core value for us. And so every job family has some level of safety. It doesn't matter what your job title is. There is some training requirement related to your job that aligns with our core values.
So it was really cool to hear you talk about all the different companies you've been with, and including starting your own. Talk about a little bit about the business value of that technology and that technology acumen, and how it's changed construction over time, from your opinion.
The technology trades were never part of a contractor's scope. They might put in the pathway for them, and then eventually security and fire alarm, I would say, were the first ones. And then when you look at some of the bigger systems, like a stadium, you then had radio and TV, broadcast cabling, those infrastructures that would have to come in. And lots of times those were also put in either by the providers themselves or the owner. And eventually, in order to finish a project, you had to integrate it into the construction, because otherwise we could build a building and it would be another year before the building was functional. And so the ask started coming from owners. Hey, can you guys help us buy this and integrate it into your schedule? And so that's where it started. I would say for some contractors, it was not willingly, but you know, it that's where it started. And another good one from the aviation side, I remember one of my early aviation projects, we had to put in payphones, and there was going to be two banks of payphones, 30 payphones. Most people wouldn't remember what that is, but we were dealing with the carriers, and the carriers move slower than wet mud. And so it was a headache to get payphones, and it was right at the as pagers were becoming popular. And so they were dragging their feet because they said, we don't want to put in 30 pay phones because we don't think we're going to make any money on them because people have pagers now. And so you start seeing where things were beginning to change, and designers were having to accommodate changes in their systems.
That's a unique perspective on it, because we're always looking at why these construction project costs have gone up, why the complexity's gone up. So you're really kind of covering that, you know, these scopes that were secondary scopes, they're now integral to what Correct. We do. I mean, in the past, you could come in and put security system in over top, some cameras, you know, throw some wires in and you were good. And now, I mean, these buildings are completely IoT. You can't put a door in many places without, you know, having it integrated into the security system.
Right.
So you're really explaining some of that scope increase, which I think is, you know, construction costs are going up, but sometimes it's because, you know, well, let's be honest, we're doing more, right? Jacob, I'm sure you have a question though.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of interesting. A few years back, I used to do some work for NAFAC, and we did some of the control centers, some of the stuff that they do on the coast, and the IT low voltage guys were actually the primes. Because the infrastructure of the low voltage and IT was so important that the building had to be, I mean, the number one thing, it had to be functioning with this IT and the security wise of it too. So they were the primes. They were the ones running the whole job, and then they would hire a plumber underneath them. They would hire all these people. So it's funny how that has now over the years even flipped at times where, hey, we are these smart buildings, these ideas of infrastructure with IT is actually leading a lot of what these projects are to the fact that we need them to actually run the project. And that's crazy to me how that's flipped.
And that's I wouldn't say all, but a lot of the cost increases are coming from, you know, just take a typical building, for example. You know, you may have $2 million, let's say $1 million worth of infrastructure, that being closets and fiber and Cat5 cabling throughout the building. But a single Cisco router is $20,000. And so if you've got 12 of those, and then you've got the subsystems, you may have $2-3 million worth of hardware cost on top of that million that you spent on infrastructure. And so, you know, you take a bigger building, a campus, for example. I did a campus job, and there were 100 IT closets. And the hardware cost was north of $100 million. Now, we didn't get to manage that, but our piece was $5 million. But the hard cost to the owner was $100 million.
The way that the buildings are being designed to function better too, actually lean on these systems a lot more too. So example would be PoE, right? You know, hey, people are going to PoE lighting. That's great. It's low voltage. You save on energy, but then there's a whole backbone. There's a whole infrastructure piece on top of that, that then adds to these costs, where obviously it's a great way to go. But looking at costs and knowing, hey, this is where it's going to creep a little bit is great.
Not to derail, but that is another big one, you know, PoE lighting, because guess what? The IT guys don't want to manage light bulbs.
Ian, you hit something, because I was at a Bixi conference quite a few years ago and saw their keynote speaker for the day. It was a panel, and it was a manufacturer of a PoE system that basically their future look was that everything in a hotel room, they were on the hospitality side, at least they were talking about, everything in the hotel room was going to be run PoE down to the hair dryer, et cetera, that they were all going to be charged. They were all going to be run that way. And they had these theories about how they can drip the electricity correctly. So talk about, I mean, $20,000 switch. Think about the power conversion racks that you need to then feed an entire system that's going to feed a whole hotel. And they were theorizing and showing a hotel room with no plugs.
That actually exists. Exists here in Fort Worth. There is a hotel in Fort Worth that they did that. That talk that you saw at Bixi was based on that hotel. And it actually exists. And their thought is the savings on running copper wire throughout the hotel and everything. Now they're saving because they're now able to run it via PoE, which is a lot lower wattage, right? Most of your PoE stuff, you're going to max out at 50 watts, I believe, and 50, 65 watts. And so, and you're running it over a 22 gauge wire. Or 20 gauge wire if it's up to Cat 6, but then you exchange that big copper transformer, etc., and you exchange it for switches and routers and power over Ethernet devices and so on and so forth. So I'm not 100% sure that it's a wash. My fingers are still jury out, but it's interesting concept, but it now puts IT guys, software guys, over light bulbs, and they don't love it.
No, they don't love that. Although what I thought was great about the talk that I saw was we talked about this because my background's IT, just the cost of running that switch gear and cost of keeping things fired up that nobody's connected to. And actually understanding the utilization of your campus or your hotel, that this would actually allow them to do a number of things. One, shut off whole areas, right, and save energy, and know from their bookings and know from their systems where to maximize and put the people and where to push the power. So there's an energy savings, but also just like little things. They didn't leave the hair dryer on the charger. They didn't leave these things where they're supposed to be, and then increase the experience. What was cool was like, then you can hook it up, and we're all seeing it now. I mean, I stay in hotels all the time and don't get a key. I just check in on my phone and walk up and boom. And this whole experience economy thing as well. So, and it's really cool to see that, you know, Jacob, you have to love this, because this is taking from construction to operation and changing the paradigm.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting too with the fact that facilities used to not include IT during building operations. So your facilities maintenance teams, facility management teams were completely separated from your IT teams. And because all this is now part of the infrastructure of the building, it is. They need the facility manager looking over what the IT guy's doing because he doesn't understand what the light bulb is. But the facility manager has no idea how to sign on to that Cisco app and understand what all these switches are doing. So now you're pairing these people together and these decisions have to be made together. Yeah. I mean, it's good for the facilities.
And it's going even crazier because, when you think about the world of digital twins and being able to optimize your building, as you talked about being able to turn on and off areas, adding that now, because usually that's another layer on top of your technology. And so you have all of your different technology systems that sometimes had to speak to each other. One system, two systems, never really three, but now you have a dozen and they all have to talk to this one platform so that the owner, I'll use a phrase that is being used a lot, under a single pane of glass can see their whole building. And a lot of it, in my opinion, it's so far forward that it might not be 100% useful today, but it's putting us on the road to where it could be more useful. I'll use a good example. We have a project where your phone will be your access control card. It will let you in the building. It will let you in the parking garage, first and foremost. So it's tied to the parking system. It will let you in the building. It will let you call the elevator to your floor. And then, that's you as an end user. It will let you book a meeting room. It will let you know restaurants in the area that you can order that would deliver to your building. And if you take it to the nth degree, instead of them having to call you and tell you your food is down at the lobby, they put it in a locker. And then the locker sends you a message saying your food has arrived.
Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress and you always get the "I'm fine" answer, but always try to dig a little deeper because people say, I haven't been sleeping great and I'm really eating crappy food and I feel anxious. I feel depressed. I feel, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on. There's some great resources. And if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptom survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if burnout's the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention. And start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. This is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and really check in.
One more resource in there, the Tough Guy Survival Kit, guy being gender neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there. And it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
You hit a huge ecosystem. It's funny. I mean, my kid's school's that way. My ski pass is now on my phone as well. So we are moving towards that. The part I want to take it back to that I think kind of comes to you and what you're personally doing is construction's always ahead of what is going to happen, right? If data center boom, data boom, you can't have that boom till you have the data center, right? So somebody has to build it. And so these skills have to be incorporated into the field, into the people building. And that's what, you know, you went from, oh, I'm the translator. I can't translate everything because I can't be everywhere every day. And probably, you know, you seem pretty deep on a lot of subjects, but you can't get as deep as you want on every subject. So you've now taken this integrator role of bringing those people together and creating a department. So tell me a little bit about that process of going from a one-man translator to a group of translators and how you're approaching that.
Well, so the initial thought process behind a group of translators were to find people who were experts in their area. So that being, get a guy who's an RCDD, he understands cabling, because that's the first side of it. Get a guy who understands access control and security, CCTV. Get someone who understands AV. And between the three of them, cross-train, because those systems are now talking to each other. Your AV system is no longer just amplifiers and speakers. It's now network. You have room schedulers. Your audio signal is actually going across the network to communicate. And so the cable guy, you know, needs to understand that. Your AV guy needs to understand he's now having to ask for IP addressing and IP address schemes. And so getting those experts in their areas and then cross-training them for them to at least have a basic knowledge of what the other is doing as a construction company. Because, you know, in some cases, they exist a little bit within companies. You know, AV guys are starting to understand technology. Cabling guys, they don't understand anything else. They just put cable in. But then you have your IT guys, who most IT guys that I have come across don't understand the infrastructure that's behind them either. They know switches and routers. You give them a switch and a router, they can program them, but they don't know how the backbone was put together. And so getting that cross-trained knowledge so that people begin to understand one another, that was the first aspect. And then from a construction side, tying that to construction, when do you bring those guys in? You know, the traditional is IT, I'll just use cable guys, they showed up at the end. Well, that's not the best time for them. We need them on the job now because I'll put it nowadays, you can't get your elevator inspection without the network working. You can't get your fire alarm without the network working. You can't get your security system without the network working. And I'll go one step further. You can't get your building management system working without the network working. And so it then became, what do we need first? One of my big challenges is still getting the traditionalists and the electricians to understand that at the same time that you're building electrical rooms, which is always one of the first things we build, you need to build the IT closets right alongside them, because the minute you turn on power, we need the IT closets, right? And to build those IT closets in a way that allows that IT infrastructure to start getting installed. You know, electricians can run disjointed infrastructure between rooms, and then, you know, and I'll use a loose term, wire nut them together, and then boom, you've got electricity. You can't do that with IT. You have to run end to end. You've got to pull your fiber. You've got to terminate it. You got to go from this room to that room, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so sometimes as an industry, we tend to be pouring concrete the night before we turn it over. Right? Yeah, IT doesn't work that way. Right? You've got to have it working. I had a project some years ago that had a 90-day system acceptance test. And what that meant was everything had to be functional. They had to operate as if the building was ready to go for 90 days. If something happened on day 89, you started the clock over.
Yeah. So it's funny. You go back to my world as an IT person, and I actually worked with a really advanced cabling guy. And he taught me the sequencing because we used to bring them all in late. And he's like, wait, you got the ceilings off? You got everything down? Mm-hmm. You got the room dismantled? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I want to get in now. And I'm like, he's like, because I can, the pathway is yes. so much easier. So before I pass this to Jacob, though, we do this on the show. We've mentioned a couple of things that I got to define. BICSI. So that's the Building Industry Consulting Services International. And their whole goal is to advance ICT, which is information and communication technology. What does that really mean? It's all your low voltage people. And you mentioned my favorite of them is an RCDD, which is a really cool data dude. So if you've been to the show, that's what they call themselves. And also, by the way, if you have never been to a BICSI show, I've spoken at BICSI. BICSI, you know, I'm open to come back. They have this whole, like, you know, like other places have badges of honor. It's how many of the stickers can you put on the front of your badge? And literally there's people walking with their badge on and all those like, I'm an RCDD. I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a this. And it's dragging on the floor.
Well,
so just a fun little piece. That,
now, almost every system now has their own certification. So if you really want to collect letters, which I refuse to do, if you're security, you would go and get an ASIS. If you were an AV guy, you get a CTS, and they have a whole set of subletters that you can get to your name for security. Yep. And so everybody's got their little badge now. I just call myself master of jack of all trades, master of none.
I like it. I just wanted to define those for people who didn't know it. And Jacob, I wanna pass it to you for your last questions there. Are you a construction company that's inundated with applications? Are you struggling to get technology adoption? Are you worried you're creating data silos? We refer to that as gray work. You want to learn more about gray work and how leading construction companies are getting past it? Then join me at QuickBase's Empower 2024. Go to quickbase.com/empower.
Yeah, actually, I just want to kind of turn it back a little bit to, I know technology was what you came back to Austin, start that kind of that department and everything, but you've kind of transitioned to this training yes. role now. And what, cause I'm assuming training now is kind of overall training for the yes. company, not just on the technology side.
That is correct. Actually, the technology side is not my primary role. So when I came back to Austin, when I took the role of training, initially I started looking at what we had, and what we had done really well at was we had content for construction engineer, project engineer to project manager. We had content to help grow those people. And what we didn't have was everybody else. And so one of the things we did was we defined that everyone needed some training. We've always had a rule that everybody should get some training, but it was never really hard and fast. It never had any structure. It never had any teeth. It never had any reward. And so the first thing we did was define that there was going to be training for everyone, and then how that was going to look. And so what we did is we kind of aligned our training requirements with our core values and found a way to apply that to everybody. And that's from captain to cook. We have a base number of hours that everyone has to get, but what we did is we subdivided those hours depending on the job title to different allotments. So, for example, safety. If you're a safety guy, you have to get a lot of safety training. If you're an administrative assistant, you don't have to get nearly as much training. But you will get some safety, because safety is one of our core values. Safety drives our everything about our business. And so we felt that everybody deserves safety. And believe it or not, you know, when I first did it, people were like, well, I'm not in the field. I don't need to know safety. But I had a safety guy many years ago who I used to have him come into the office and give office safety, you know. People get workers' comp for paper cuts. And so office people needed to know safety, you know, don't stand on your chair to reach something on the top shelf, and, you know, those kinds of things. And so we said that safety was going to be part of everybody's training. And then we have other categories. And then the next big thing was, then once you've done that, is we need to have content for them. And so we have online classes. We have speakers that come in, and we try to get different speakers from various types of industries and topics. And we have meetings, regular training meetings. And it's, you know, some job sites have regular training where they, you know, they'll come in and they'll say, okay, today we're going to, this month we're going to learn about, let's do better RFIs, because, you know, whatever. And so they have training. And so we're able to track that. And you as a end user, we created a dashboard that tracks those credits, and you can look in anytime and see what you're doing. The next evolution for that is managers can now look in, and let's say you have a subordinate and you want to see how they're doing on their training. You know, training becomes part of the review process. I prefer to call it, there's performance and then there's development, right? So performance is how you're doing your job. Development is how are you developing yourself to do your job. And so I look at training as a development process. And so I wanted managers to be able to look in and see, you know, when during the review, during the performance review, your manager knows where your deficiencies are. And so he could look in and say, you know what, Jacob, you know, I you're having difficulty. I know you, your writing skills are not as good. In the next year, go take some writing classes. And training department, do you all have any writing classes? And so there's classes online that you can take. And if we don't, maybe you go to a community college and take those, and we put them in the system and track them. And so next review, your manager should have a lot easier, because he should look and say, you know what, Jacob, I see that you have improved your writing, right? And you will go, and someone will go, well, why is that important? Well, guess what? If you do a great job writing your RFIs, your architects will answer you better and faster. And you, the turnaround, it's hard to put a monetary value on some of the training, but it's intangible, right? If you're better at your job, it means you're going to do it more efficiently. You're going to do it more happy. And if you learn something along the way, let's pretend you looked in the system and, you know, you're an administrative assistant, but you wanted to learn about BIM. Well, you started learning building information modeling. Now you might be able to transfer into the BIM department based on your desire and what you've trained yourself with. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm a firm believer in that. It's a captain to cook training opportunity. And as an organization, the more you spend time training for the next opportunity, the better you're going to be.
That's really well said, Ian. And I laughed because as an IT person, I'm one of the few that's had to have an incident, a safety incident. I reached behind a desk and somebody punched a hole in the desk for the cables with a tool that just left all the metal shards sticking out like that. And I just reached over to grab something and slice. I still have the stitches mark right there. So safety in the office is important. Safety at the core is important. Integrating training from captain to cook is a great one. I want to steal that one, Jacob. I'm thinking like, we got to steal that. Captain to cook. It's also speaks to, I think, you know, when you say you don't do the IT thing anymore, I think a lot of what you just talked about integrates the technology, integrates the core systems, integrates the things that you're talking about. And Austin has realized that if you're going to train on anything, you need to train on everything. And it's, I believe, just a testament to the fact that technology isn't a separate thing. It's core to our business. It's core to what we do in construction. It's core to what we do in almost every vertical that's out there. I mean, so it's really cool to see you ascend through that process and take this role where, you know, you have an eye on all the things that are going on. So,
right. I still dabble, just to be sure. I still dabble a little bit. And I'll say this, I consider the IT, and I use that term loosely because I have... a few years ago, I started writing down all of the things that would be considered IT, and I came up with 27 different systems. Okay, depending on the industry, there's more, there's less. But I considered the infrastructure the fourth utility. You have electrical, plumbing, HVAC, and IT. And I'll give you the story. I've heard, I can't verify, but I've heard that there's a famous, really famous female singer who is married to a really famous rapper. And when they go to a building to look for a new space, the first thing she does is she pulls out her phone and goes, "Do I have signal?" And if they don't have signal, they walk out the building and go somewhere, someplace else. So it could be the most beautiful building, but if the Wi-Fi doesn't work and you don't have any bars, you're about to lose a customer.
That's a mic drop right there, Jacob.
Yeah, I agree.
Ian, it's been great to have you on the show. You know, where can people learn a little bit about more about what you're up to, maybe connect with you? Where are you active in the world these days?
I'll be ashamed to admit that I'm not as active as I probably should be. I am on LinkedIn. That's the first place that you'll go. I don't spend a lot of time there, but that's where you would be the first place to go look.
All right. Well, and I'm sure you can find out more about Austin and what they're up to. And I appreciate you coming down and stay with us, because I think your perspective is going to be really powerful on our news. So with that, it's time for the Construction Technology News of the Week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. Jacob, what do you got?
All right. So going back to facilities dive here, pulled in a piece of industrial real estate to heat up in 2024, which is somewhat mind-boggling considering industrial real estate is red hot right now. What is interesting about it, and I speak about this probably about on every show now, ESG, this is the year of it. I wholeheartedly expect that we're just going to see the impact of ESG skyrocket. Well, what this report is predicting is the fact that there is a lot of industrial space unused, still unused. And what you're going to see because of ESG goals is a lot of redevelopment with that. So a lot of reusing, becoming more efficient, but also redefining what that space can be, which in a world right now where we're seeing a lot on the new construction of the, you know, industrial side, everything is booming with new construction, EV, new chip plants. This is talking a lot about, hey, let's go back and reuse these old facilities, upgrade them, make it an EV plant, make it something that we need to use. But you're going to see that, and it's going to be impacted because of the ESG goals and being able to reuse a space instead of something new. So as much as the past 2 years, I believe, has been this boom in like new construction for industrial, I think we're going to start seeing, hey, there's even, I don't think that's going to slow down as much, but I think you're going to see a lot more in this, hey, let's renovate, let's redo what we can do in the industrial.
I'll give you a new word. We'll call it repurpose.
Yeah.
Yep. You're exactly right. That repurposing, because a couple of things that you mentioned, those EV factories, those chip factories, those, you know, big plants that are being built are gobbling up the space and making the land more expensive. And so for those that are, you know, smaller, nimble, or maybe just burgeoning, you know, groups, the idea of going in and doing a repurposing of a facility is going to be powerful. Plus, those facilities jumped around during the pandemic with a boom and a bust, and the ESG goals are huge on this one. And I think it drives also for our listeners, like, this is an opportunity, Jacob, that, you know, if you can up your TI group when it comes to, or your, you know, your repurposing group, as we'll call it, TI on that. I don't know if you call it the same thing, but with laser scanning, reality capture, you know, to bring it into BIM, to then look at it and digitally remodel it and do it fast, you're going to have a leg up on your competition, because they're going to say like, oh, well, we don't know. And here's our drawings or here's whatever. And you're like, no, we got in, we scanned, here's the reality of what we're doing. Or, hey, we haven't done it there, but look what we've done at these other buildings. Let us get in there. We'll tell you how to efficiently do it. We'll tell you what you can use and reuse. We'll tell you and show you in a model how we can move things around. And I also think if you're a construction company, you should be thinking about constructing fabrication shops. And these are the greatest places, because fab has to be close to what's going on. These EV factories can be wherever in the middle of nowhere they want to be, and can build the infrastructure around them. If you're doing a fab shop and you've got to get things to a downtown area, you need to be close. You need staging. You need those kinds of things. So that's where my head went.
I actually 100% agree with that. That is a great repurpose of these facilities, because you can open the shop up, you can divide it up to your subs. Hey, you got this area, you got this area. And then you can also do the whole combination in the middle. We're going to do multi-trade. Boom. We're all putting this together.
I would say that it's probably going to be more on the sub side. A lot of the subcontractors, and it's mostly driven by the mechanical guys and somewhat the electrical guys, mm-hmm. that are leading the way on the fabs, the pre-construction. And then, of course, in some cases, we do bring them together to build elements. That usually works a lot for the healthcare. The challenge with construction, mm-hmm. and this is something that is another side passion of mine. We didn't talk much about it, but I love the idea of pre-construction and prefabbing. As an industry, it's hard. So I'm always trying to figure out how do we build a better mousetrap. And because generally, mm-hmm. Construction is the only industry, if you look at major manufacturing type industries, where every job is a prototype, right? The efficiencies of repetitive work just don't exist in construction generally. So the only way to do it is to break it up into pieces that could be repetitive, i.e. bathrooms, i.e. if it's a healthcare facility, patient rooms or operating theaters. But generally, every owner wants their building to look as distinct from the other building as possible. And so even if you build the same building on two different lots, it's different. The site conditions would be different. The weather would be different. Everything is different. And so we never really have, you can't really ever get the full efficiencies without breaking it down into smaller bites. But instead of building every single piece on site, you find the biggest piece that you can put together off site to bring it in. And to be honest, that's what's driving the speed of construction now, not necessarily the dollars, but the speed, because now if I can start building wall panels in a factory a year before I need it on the site.
Yeah. And it's time is money, money's expensive. So time is expensive. And I have this idea though, and I've been circulating, and I'm gonna throw it past you guys just so you understand it. I think if you look, the three of us look very, very different, right?
No.
But if you go below,
you have hair.
Yeah. I have hair. You guys don't, you know what I mean? Like you wear glasses. I don't. But if you realize, if you take all the outer stuff off, the circulatory systems, our heart, our organs, all of that is the same. And we have to start looking at buildings, and you've talked about it. And this is what I love is the convergence of the integration of electrical, mechanical, plumbing, and the electrification of all of that is converging, so that we can start to get architects and owners to understand that while the outside can look like, you know, beautiful Jacob over there, and the inside can operate the same, and we can start productizing, reusing, the outsides are prototypes, but the inside, well, that's a circulatory system. And I think, you know, Mother Nature got that right. And I think that's the progression, but the convergence of the technologies, the convergence of the systems is also part of that. So, and you're right. Like we're always going to have concrete. We're always going to have not concrete, but we're always going to have some sort of foundation, and we're always going to have some sort of structural integrity. But a lot of that again can be done off, but the internal workings can be done off site and can be brought on and can be done a lot faster, a lot safer. And honestly, that means cheaper, right? Because if it's faster, it's cheaper. The cost of the goods isn't going to go down, but the time to get it there is, and that means the cost goes down. So I love it. Jacob, what else you got for us, brother?
All right. So my next article, Construction Dive, and it's Bechtel pledges $7 million to combat suicide in construction. First off, applaud to Bechtel. Love seeing this article. It is actually the single highest donation in the organization AFSP. That is great. I love it. This is awesome article. Applaud Bechtel. The one thing I want to point out with this article, which is kind of, and I don't know if maybe I've been absent a little bit, but during COVID, there was a lot of talk about mental health. There was a lot of going on. Companies were getting engaged. They were part of it. They were doing all this. I feel like it's died off. I feel like, oh, all right, COVID, everybody's not inside, stuck to themselves, so you don't have to worry about it as much. And I kind of feel like it's not as front in the conversations anymore. So really kind of coming out of nowhere, I see this as a huge push for Bechtel. I mean, Jeff, I know you are very involved in suicide prevention and what we're doing, but I just love seeing it again. Let's keep talking about it. Let's keep going out there and making sure that this is a problem that we need to solve.
Let's talk about it a little bit, if you don't mind. You've kind of that struck a little nerve with me, because I've thought about that a lot back when COVID, you know, during COVID, most industries went remote. Construction didn't go remote, right? We were deemed an essential service. And so hats off to all of the guys who still had to go, whether you're a project manager or you were a laborer, you went to work. Right. You still had to work while your family was at home. And so mental health doesn't necessarily speak the same in construction as it does to some of the other industries. And I think the conversation, you know, $7 million is probably a drop in the ocean when you talk about it from a construction industry. There's another article out there that's been recent that drug use is highest in the construction industry. You know, which is weird to me because we drug test everybody, right? But it is, and people are using drugs to cope, to survive. You know, when you consider you've got to feed your family, and so therefore you're working 50, 60 hours in a week, you know, because you have to pay the bills, you have to survive. Mental health doesn't necessarily mean anything to those guys.
Now, you hit on a couple of things there. The $7 million is a drop in the bucket, but it is the biggest drop so far, or a drop in the ocean, but it's the biggest drop so far. And what I really hope, and I was reading through this looking for it, and in my opinion, you know, suicide is unfortunately the symptom, and we've got to treat the problem. And we have high levels of burnout. We have Ian, you talked about this, like people that I don't think understand that, like a lot of our construction workers of all types, right, of our trades, of our GCs, they are mobilized and they move around and they're away from their families for extended periods of time. They're missing those moments, and it works on them. And it's core to their mental fitness and their mental health. And, you know, also, yeah, we have injuries, and then that leads to drug use from a prescriptive perspective, but then we know those, you know, that endemic we had in a country around opioids that led to a lot of this. So we have a lot of undoing to do, and we have a lot, but we have a lot of opportunity in this process to get back to the beginning. And if you can give an ounce of prevention, it will drive pounds of relief. And that's what we need. We need more physical therapy and more occupational therapy. We need more mental fitness. We need to treat health and safety as the same thing. We need to treat, because at the core of this world of construction is people. We cannot get away from it. We're never going to get away from it. I don't want to get away from it. I want to make them some of the most technologically advanced humans on the planet, but there's a key word in there. I want them to be human.
But owners turn around and say, I want my building faster. I want to be able to make money with my building.
Yep. And that's where there is a constant pressure, and you're right. And we need to be working on, and that's why, you know, to tie it back to your first article, Jacob, that's why we need an offsite. That's why we need modular. That's why we need prefab. That's why we need design for manufacturing and assembly. Sitting at the table, we should be looking at owners and saying, and architects, I'll be honest, architects and engineers as well, and saying, listen, This is a huge problem. This is a huge need for you. And we're telling you that this is the way we have to do it. So change is the only option, because we're you know, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Definition of insanity. Yes. So, yeah, but it's great to see the focus. But Jacob, I agree with you. Coming out of COVID, there was still talk about it, and we still have, you know, talks about mental health. However, we're busy being busy, to Ian's point, right? We got, hey, I'd love to get to this, but I can't get to the technology. I can't get to the suicide and mental health. I can't. Why? Because I got deadlines. I got schedules. I got things. So there's a point at which we have to push back and advance ourselves in some way, shape, or form. And I don't have the answer. You know, this is the beauty of being a host here. I just get to say it.
I'll give you a start. You know, a lot of companies don't think about safety. Some companies focus on safety and as safety on the job. And we, as an industry, we have a mantra that says everybody goes home at the end of the day. But if you take it a step further and says everyone comes in safe at the end of the day, because, for example, if you went home tired and you came back to work tired, you're an accident waiting to happen. And so as an industry, we push safety, right? That's our bucket. And that's where I think we as an industry start, because we're very much focused on safety in the job, pre-task planning, JHAs, and all the different matrices. Mm-hmm. We're talking about putting sensors on people to know when they hit a unsafe spot and track productivity. Let's start and say safety, and let's take that to the nth degree. How do we keep our people safe so that they can be productive? And it might be training. It might be making sure that, you know what, if a guy has worked 7 months and he hasn't taken a day off, we mandate as a company, and I'm not saying the government, but we as a company say, dude, you're not going to be any good for us. So you need to take a week off. You need to take your vacation. And I'll be the first to tell you, I'm really bad about taking my company-provided vacation, right? And some companies have use it or lose it. But I like to think of our trades guys as well. And so you got to take that vacation time. You got to take the days off to reset and recharge. And my dad, I'll use this one example from my dad. He did something. He used to do something that most people don't do. He would shut his company down every year between Christmas and New Year's. Everybody took vacation at the same time. He shut it down. Everybody went home, and we started back in January. So everybody got a break.
It's a great process. We see it in tech a lot. And I have to grab you there. I want to take that nugget on safety and mental health have to just be locked at the hip. And we have to start thinking about that as a single continuum. Or we're not gonna get there. But I will tell you, the interesting thing is if you go across the country, I'll hear people, you know, clamoring for it, but I'll see industry associations ignoring it and not tackling it. And let's just be honest, like, it is not fun, and people don't love it, and it's really uncomfortable, but like any good change is. So I agree with you.
Nobody wants to be responsible for the guy after he leaves the job site, right? Because if you are responsible for the guy after he leaves the job site, that opens up a whole another section of liability and risk.
It's interesting, though. I mean, Jacob, I think you remember back. I think it was it may have been a Hilti. I forget who it was, but they were drilling holes in
it's Hilti concrete. And the exoskeleton.
Yeah. And they had one using the exo and one not. And they were like measuring all the heart rates and everything. And the interesting thing to me on that one was like, wait a minute, if we measured the heart rates and other things, we would know where exhaustion was. We would know things like you said, Ian. So pretty cool stuff. So Hilti, you know, I think the exoskeleton, by the way, the second round of it is super cool. I had it over my head at MEP Innovations recently. I love it. But that was the thing I got out of that. So I'm going to move us on though. ABC, that's mine today. ABC's AI in construction. What does it mean for our contractors? If you wake up and you don't hear about AI, tell me where you live, because I'm going to come there and hang out for a little bit, because I could use a day off from AI. However, it is fundamentally changing the way we look at the speed to which we can do things. It's really opening our eyes to a lot. It is having a huge impact on technology and its advancements. It's starting to help us look at data and turn it into information. But what's cool is, a lot of people just don't understand it, and they hear it and they want to curl up. And Ian, I know you're a reader, so this is a great one, because it goes through the definitions of artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, generative AI, and then starts to look at, you know, some of the groups that exist right now for, say, pre-construction or, you know, construction itself and robotics and autonomous equipment. And it's just a really, really good overview, so people can dig in and feel comfortable. You know, there's some HR considerations built into it. So I just really wanted to send out an opportunity for people to find this. And, you know, congratulations to the team over at ABC. We're big fans of Matt Abels and the group over there. And I'm fairly sure he had a lot to do with that article. So Jacob, I mean, it's AI's on the tip of our tongue. This one was just more like, where can somebody go get info? What'd you think?
Hats off to ABC for doing this. A lot of their members don't know where to start. They don't know what to listen to, what to go with, how to implement it, or even what could exist that's going to harm them. This is a great start. I love it. I saw when they actually first announced this and brought it out. I wish more and more industry organizations do this, including groups like AIA for designers, because there is so much impact that AI can have, but there is so much unknown. I mean, I'm a huge, you know me, I love AI. I love everything about it, but there is a lot that could get you in trouble. And I think individuals need to understand, and especially if you own a company, you need to be understanding what AI is and what it's going to do for your company, so you guys can go implement this. This is great. I'm very happy with ABC.
My two cents is going to be that I would tell anyone that is feeling overwhelmed by the depth of AI and what all, you know, we're hearing about. It doesn't replace the human element. It doesn't matter what AI looks at. It doesn't replace the creativity and the processing of the human element. And so I've seen a lot of things that AI does, but humans still have to look at it. It's kind of like I can give you a 10,000 cell spreadsheet and it has all kinds of information in it, right? But if you don't know how to parse that down to a sentence, which is where humans can come in, and AI is getting better and it's trying to do some of the things that humans can do, but it still requires a human element. So we won't replace ourselves. They'll get better, but we won't replace ourselves.
Yeah, I kind of wish somebody along the way, instead of calling it artificial, was augmented intelligence, something of
supplementary,
that nature, because it really is. It's doing, supplemented it, because it is providing us and gathering and doing things that like we can do. You know, I had a great conversation with somebody who said, you know, the founder of a company that said, listen, I don't care if I'm really using an AI or if I've got 50 people in India, they're reading everything and giving back the same thing. To me, it's, can you augment the need for the information so that we can do decision-making off of it, so that we can think it through, so that we can apply it to the situation that we have, our problem solving, our understanding of our environment, our understanding of our owner's needs, of our trades needs, et cetera. So you're right. That's what it's all about. And this gives a really good understanding of, you know, just all the things that go into that. This has been going on for a long time. So it's just another piece, but it is, you do need to read it. You do need to get involved and not be scared, because it isn't going anywhere. It is here for real. So good stuff out there, ABC. I'm going to jump to one of my favorite ones, and I'm a huge tech brew fan, right? I got into the brew world, morning brew, tech brew, and this was super cool because to see our world cross over into others, it's a new report identifies significant skills gap in the U.S. battery industry. So growing battery demand signals a time-sensitive and nationwide need to fortify industry with a skilled workforce, according to new research. So this is really great because, you know, with the boom in EV and the boom in that area, we need skilled labor to help us as a part of that. So 82% of respondents reported a shortage of skilled local applicants. Here's the thing. We're fighting for people. They're fighting for people. We're looking to upskill. They're looking to upskill. This is a huge opportunity to look at the needs of both industries and to understand that as the efforts gain momentum and industries change, people need to be upskilled and trained to come along with it. And we also need to position ourselves, and they need to position themselves, like Ian said earlier, as an alternative to classic educational models, right? Not everyone needs to go to a four-year college. Not everyone needs to get certain degrees. Lots of people can go through apprenticeship programs. Lots of people can go through community college programs that really teach you a trade skill, that give you something to build off of. You know, I know many business owners in the trades and in general contracting that started as a laborer, that started as an apprentice, that started as an electrician or a mechanical, and it became a passion and they built a business out of it. And as they grew, I was talking to one the other day that said, man, if I had tried to go to business school when I was 19, I never would have gotten anywhere, and who knows where I'd be. And instead, I came out and I was a tradesperson and I was a laborer. And then I was a mechanical, worked in the mechanical trades, piping, welding. And then I said, hey, there's a business here. I should go learn about it. Went to school at night, got an MBA, got the degrees, and now runs a huge mechanical contracting company that's super successful, but always has that grounded piece. And I love this because when I was in college, I worked for a restaurant owner, and he came up the same way, right? Learned how to cook things, learned how to do all that stuff. And he said, you know what makes me go to bed really good every night, Jeff, is if everything goes to hell in a handbasket, I can take that bag of flour back there and I can make bread and dinner and food for my family for a long time. And that's what the mechanical contractor said. He said, I went out and took this risk because, well, in the end, if it didn't work, I'd go back to welding and pipe fitting and doing those things. So pretty cool to see that other industries are going to join us in this fight. And a little teaser, I might have somebody coming on that's working on this in the future. So just stay tuned for that one.
I think the challenge for us is we have to define where the real need is. So yes, there's a shortage of EV, but what does that mean, right? Battery technology, there's people that's doing research in battery technology all over the world. So it's not that area. There's factories building batteries. So it's not that world, which of course that's going, especially on the robotic side, they're using more robots to build those. But it's the implementation of it. What equipment they're putting the batteries in. When you put them in the equipment, how do you service it? When one breaks down, can you repair it? And so that's what the message that's not going out is, where the opportunities are, is to figure out, is to publicize where the real opportunities are. You know, just saying that there's a shortage doesn't necessarily, you have to go dig to understand where the shortages are.
Well, yeah, and a shortage of people to install, competently install the charging.
Correct.
The associated infrastructure that we needed to do it correctly. Yeah. The associated entire, you know, new markets are being built around this and causing huge disruption and need. And look, the car itself doesn't operate the same. So you can't take your Tesla to the same place your you Ford. Take your, your Ford. And, but you can take your Ford, your Chevy, your Subaru, whatever it is, gas powered to one place and they're good to go. We don't really have that for EV yet at scale, and we're going to need it because they break down. So Jacob, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on it, my man.
Some of those auto body shop, or not auto body, but the mechanic shops that are nationwide are starting to, they've realized this. So if you see Meineke's now, you will actually see Meineke EV, and they've put a V at the end of Meineke, and now they actually are servicing EVs at the same site. But once again, that's, I mean, obviously the investment's needed. They see the market, but there's a whole up training there. There is not like, hey, the same guy can go work on both. So how do we identify the right people to do it? And then also it's the trade colleges and the universities or the schools. You have your mechanic shops and everything that are doing this. I mean, I live here in North Carolina. NASCAR is up and down everywhere. So every single school has a auto, you know, shop. Yeah. And it's a degree, but now it's going to be, hey, what about this, you know, technology side? How does the EV work? Can we do the same thing, get the same degree? Because you're going to have to know how to deal with both here when you come out of school or get into the market.
Yeah, so that ties back to another passion of mine is getting into the high schools. One of the things that I believe our schools don't do a good job at of today, is because of all the talk, is putting people in the right place, understanding the student to put them in the right place to be successful. You know, up until recently, the push was to push kids towards getting a four-year degree. Everybody had to go to college. Now it's everybody, you know, you don't have to go to college, but you should go get a trade. But they're not pushing the right trades. And it's real simple. The guidance counselors don't know all the opportunities that are out there. My son graduated a year ago, and they were pushing him, of course, towards engineering. But the guidance counselor had no clue that there were opportunities in construction, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, all of these different things. You know, he took 3D modeling as an elective, but the guidance counselor had no idea that there was a thing called BIM, right? So they pushed him towards engineering. Yep. So we, the industries, need to educate the guidance counselors so that they can have that counselor that does like what my dad did and look at a student and says, you know, you have a particular aptitude. Here is the thing that fits your aptitude. And maybe it's a software that somebody builds. You know, maybe us three needs to get together and build an AI aptitude software that matches aptitude to careers. But the guidance counselors have no, that's a big deficiency.
You're right. That's a big nugget, though. Maybe somebody out there listening can help you build that. In fact, I was just looking at a couple of companies that are doing those kinds of things with new technology. So, well, listen, guys, we can go on forever, but we got to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming on. Jacob, bringing another great guest, digging it. Thanks for sitting down with me today.
I absolutely enjoyed it. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you both of you.
Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Ian Theodore. To read all our news stories, to learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is the Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.